Wednesday, September 27th. Okay. My anniversary. Actually, it's my month anniversary. 300 weeks today. And my daughter's anniversary, 9 years. And my cousin's 70th birthday. Okay, you don't need to know all that. But okay. All right. So, as I was saying, I'll try not to introduce new material, but I will expand on anything that we've talked about or answer questions about the text, anything else you are interested in. I will be happy to hear your interpretations of things or examples or illustrations and comment on those. I'm here until some other class comes in or until we run out of steam and you're all gone. When you need to go, if you have other things to do or you get bored, feel free just to get up and leave, and you won't all have to stay here until the last person runs out of questions. Okay? Yes. What changes are included in biological development from the study questions? What are they? Yeah. And anything that is the body and any change that the body is going through is fair game in biological development. Both the body and the uses of the body. So, for example, when we talk about walking, that's part of what we're learning to walk is part of biological development. So, yeah, if it happens to your body, it's a biological development. Or if it's in the use of your body. Yes? Yeah, the question is decline in development or deterioration, decline in physiological function or deterioration, is that still considered part of development? That's an interesting semantic question that developmentalists love to argue about. And the text says that their choice is to use development for expectable changes, without making a judgment about whether it has to be a positive or negative change. So if it's deterioration, that's a development. And most of us don't any longer say that development has to be progressive or positive. But I do know people who will argue that you need another name for deterioration and don't include that in human development. But I think they lose just on the basis of numbers. So yeah, changes can be positive or negative or neutral. I'm just noticing the Shelton football sweatshirt up here. Connecticut?
American Eagle.
Huh. Okay. Make a note for me to go get a Shelton football T-shirt at American Eagle, or a sweatshirt at American Eagle. I hadn't seen that. You wore that just to flatter me, right?
I'm giving it to you.
No. And I won't repeat that offer on the iPod. So we won't put your attempt to bribe me. Other questions? Yes. Okay, the study question is, what do parents give their children at the beginning?
Yeah.
And how do they do it?
Okay.
And what's your answer to that? So what parents give us at the very beginning is their jeans.
Yeah.
Right. Not their sweatshirts, their jeans. Right. So that's what you get from your parents. All of us get our genes from those biological parents, and they do it by combining sperm and ovum. Then there are other things after that, but that's the very beginning. Conception is the beginning. Then after that, we will save most of that for the third unit when we talk about attachment and parenting behaviors, and talk about those other interactions that parents have with their children. But in this unit, the easiest answer for that is their genes.
When you talk about like how do you learn to walk and stuff like that, are you looking for answers like about the neurons being all the connections in the brain, or about like the muscles
The question is, when I ask about learning to walk, am I talking about the neurons being connected in the brain, or am I talking about the muscles? Let me make a general statement about the question, because there's a general principle, which is that whenever you find yourself in this course or any of my courses being tempted to ask a question that is it this or that? Whenever you hear yourself asking this or that, flip a little switch in your brain and substitute "and" where the "or" was. Okay. And you'll probably get closer to what you should be thinking about. So rarely is it a this or a that. It's most often here this and that and a couple of more things and whatever else. So, yes, when we're talking about learning how to walk, we probably should talk about the biological changes that make that possible and the exercise and opportunity and motivation that encourage the creation of those motor skills and the practice that make those motor skills more refined. When we're talking about motor skills, we probably also should talk about differentiation. You have to figure out how to control each part of the body, and then you have to figure out how to integrate those parts that you've learned to control into the larger action of walking. So it's all of those. And the study questions often are designed to get you to think about the whole big picture. You know, it's not a simple answer. It's, okay, what all do I have to take into account when I try to address a development such as walking? And what are the different parts that I need to think about in that? And hopefully over the course of the semester, you'll become really comfortable with thinking about, well, okay, we have to think about this, we have to think about this, we have to think about this, and we have to think about how they work together. And that's really the process of development, is pulling those different parts together so that they're integrated, and that's what creates the development.
One of the questions says, when does biological development stop? No, that would be death, right?
That would be death, yeah. The question was, when does biological development stop? And if you take the view that change is development, then death is when we're going to end the course. But when you take forensic biology, you get to talk about what happens after death. But I'm not a forensic biologist, and I don't like corpses, so we're not going to talk about that.
Yes.
How dangerous is it? Okay, the question is, the text talks about the the formation of the face, and it uses the term peninsula, which is a bud, an extension out from the sides of the nasal oral opening. So those peninsulas are growing out and forming eventually the upper lip and the palate. And some, what I described in class was that sometimes they don't completely join. How dangerous is it depends on how incomplete the fusion is. It's potentially fatal. And that was the example I gave in class, that my father and his two brothers had a fourth brother who died. And the cause of death, died in infancy shortly after he was born. And the cause of death on the death certificate is cleft palate. Back in the 1908, I think, 7 or 8. Because the surgical techniques were not available. So if you can't correct it, then it can be fatal, and that's pretty serious. And it's fatal because you end up aspirating or breathing food down into your lungs and you get pneumonia and infection and you die. Or you can't eat and you starve to death. And every time you try to eat, you gag. So it doesn't take very long to figure out, even for a newborn, I don't want to do this. So you stop trying, and every time you try, you stop because it's gagging you, and you don't want to do that. Okay. So it is very serious to have a cleft palate, and that's why there's so much attention paid to corrective surgery, to restoring that. At some point soon, do you all know about community medical school? No. Okay. Community medical school is medical school for everybody, anybody who wants to come. It's free. Every couple of weeks, medical school faculty give a lecture on something, and it's Tuesdays at 6 in Carpenter Auditorium. If you look on the UVM events on the web, it lists the topic. And I think the next topic, I've forgotten which Tuesday it is, and I'm hoping it wasn't yesterday, is reconstructive and plastic surgery. And I'm sure that they will be talking a bit about that. The title is Robbing Peter to Pay Paul, because in your plastic surgery, you have to get tissue from somewhere. So if you're doing a skin graft, you know, you shave it off the hip and put it on the face or wherever you need it. If you're doing it in the palate, you either have to do a plastic insert or you have to take tissue from someplace else. The one after that is sex differences in the brain and how they develop. And that's going to be fun. But the university, for those of you who are first or second year students and haven't discovered this huge smorgasbord, I'll put in a plug for looking at the events and anything that intrigues you, just go. You don't have to get credit for it. You don't even have to take notes. But there are all kinds of wonderful lectures and films and discussions that happen at any university that are there for anybody who wants to partake. And the community medical school is put on for the community. But anybody can go. It's fun. So if you want to know more about plastic surgery, community medical school at 6. Yes? No, a cleft chin is one of the normal variations in chin shape. The cleft chin just simply means that you have a dent.
So that has nothing to do with
it? I actually don't know how a cleft chin is formed. There are two parts to a cleft chin. This is new material, but it's related. One is that some people have actually a dent in the bone, the way the bone grows. Other people have the flesh has a dimple in it, and it's just the way the underlying structure of the flesh has formed. And some people have both, and some people have very significant cleft chins, and some of us don't have much cleft at all. And it's, as far as I know, it's just normal. Okay, two-part question. Can some women, are there women who don't go through menopause? Yes, but you won't like the reason. So they die before menopause. The body is designed, you're just not going to keep maturing those ova, and you're eventually going to stop producing the estrogen. I suppose it would be theoretically possible to continue, but I don't know what the condition would be, and I've never heard of it. That doesn't mean it's there, not there. Second part was, why is menopause worse or more difficult for some women than others? There are a number of reasons for that, and that the text describes some of them, but one of those is that the responsiveness of the body to hormone changes differs among people. Some people have a hypothalamus-pituitary communication link that really is never quite right. Some women continue to secrete large amounts of hormones from the adrenal cortices, and their body is responding to that. So the extremes are experiencing perimenopausal symptoms for 10 years or more. I had a secretary at one point who was going through menopause, and she had been, it was an interesting situation because I took her out to lunch when I hired her. I took her out to lunch with the woman she was replacing, and after we sat down to lunch, she had a hot flash, and she just, personal summer, broke out in a sweat, flush, all that, took off her jacket and sweater, and just said, excuse me, I'm having a hot flash. And so it started a discussion about her menopause, and she'd been having very severe hot flashes regularly, daily, for 4 or 5 years. And it was being difficult for her. She'd just adapted to this as the way it is. The sad thing was that the woman she was replacing didn't give her a lot of encouragement, because she explained that her mother had gone through about 10 years of hot flashes, and that she didn't need to hear that at that point. And then there are women who never have a hot flash. I know a mother-daughter pair who both stopped menstruating, just stopped menstruating. Didn't realize they were perimenopausal, had never had any problems. The mother stopped. Her last period was when she was 43. Her daughter was when she was 42. And both of them just stopped. And so they listened to their friends in both generations talk about all the problems they're having, and they can't relate because they just stopped menstruating. The granddaughter is hoping when she gets there that'll be the way she does it. The genetic variations, physiological variations, some people appear to have more difficulty psychologically, in part, and this is where the research is really slim, in part because of the cognitive problems. A lot of women report that they have memory and problem-solving, analytic difficulties for several months around the time they stop menstruating, and there is some evidence for that. Other women have a long period of that. Other women don't notice it at all. So there's something going on in the brain with the way it's processing information or storing. That's a variable. Another variable is attitude. Many women have a great deal of difficulty with menopause, and it appears to be largely psychological. They don't like the physical changes that are taking place, and one of the major elements in that in our culture, particularly in our culture, is that women are very reluctant to give up being childbearing, youthful, We live in an ageist society that has very negative attitudes about postmenopausal women. And so many women are very reluctant. They fear it. And the more they fear it, the more difficulty they're going to have. In our culture, the research as reported in the text is pretty clear that if you have a positive attitude about it and are looking forward to it, you don't have nearly as many problems psychologically in dealing with it. And let me expand on that a little bit. Because in other cultures, menopausal women don't report any problems at all. It's just part of life. You go through it. That's what happens. In our culture, attitude seems to be really important, and it appears to be related to the ageism. There are some very interesting social responses to that. I have a group of women friends who have all been through puberty, or been through menopause. They went through puberty too, all through menopause, and they kind of support each other, but they have decided that they're just going to revel in being old women. And this group of women, probably the youngest is 63 or 4, and the oldest is 80. And they get together every other week for some kind of outrageous breakfast or lunch, or they go out and drink too much, you know, all those things that they do. But they, and it's all women, and no men are allowed, and they just revel in being old women. So they make jokes about their wrinkles and their white hair, and they encourage each other to stop dyeing their hair. Now, there comes a point when it doesn't look natural anymore, and they call themselves the crones. And a crone, anybody know the meaning of the term? An old woman, and that's the name of their group. It actually has a modifier, but I'm not going to add that because it indicates the town they live in. Let them go on about it. Now, let me connect attitude about menopause and difficulty with attitude about puberty and difficulty at puberty. And again, you can check in the text. Anybody remember what the text says about girls going through puberty? The ones who have menstrual cramps and problems and miss school and pain? Yeah, it's depressing. It's annoying. But who experiences that? Who's most likely to experience that? Right. One of the elements in that is age. The younger you are, the more likely you are to have difficulty with it. Women whose fathers do not know they are menstruating are more likely to be having problems with menarche and menstruation. And what that suggests is that in families where sex is not talked about, and people don't have open attitudes about what's going on biologically. In other words, where fathers who live in the household do not know their daughters are menstruating yet, so it's a secret. Those girls have more problems, more pain, miss school more, and have more difficulty with menstruation generally. So again, it appears that attitude has a real connection to the way you experience biological change and whether it's difficult for you.
It's just a technicality. Are substances teratogenic or are deformities teratogenic?
The question is, which is teratogenic? The substances, the chemicals, or the deformities? The substances or the causes of the deformities. The deformities are what has been caused by the teratogen. Another way of saying that would be that there are substances, there are things that cause distortion in development And we could call them distortionogenic or deformitygenic, but we'll call them teratogens. Yeah. No, the question is whether you need to know the days and weeks on the prenatal development chart. Now, just hang on to it in case you go back through prenatal development again or are watching somebody else. You do need to know roughly when you change from being an embryo to being a fetus. You ought to know approximately when that happens. You also ought to know the difference and the importance of that difference between an embryo and a fetus. But beyond that, I'm not... No, changes... that's actually the beginning of the heart is the change that we didn't talk about, but it's the change between the germinal stage and the beginning of the first internal organs and the embryonic stage. You're an embryo during the period when you're beginning to form any of the organs. And you become a fetus when all of those organs have been started, around 8 to 10 weeks. So the embryonic stages, those first 2 months.
The graph that you were doing on the board today,
yep.
And this kind of relates to one question, you were saying that being like well exercised and eating well and stuff like that is going to like basically prolong like, that's not technically delayed. That's just like, that's just improving the way you're aging.
Let me see if I can repeat the question as you intended, which is that the exercising and staying fit will increase your lifespan. And the question is that only true in the later ages? No, it's true from the beginning. The healthier you are at the beginning, in your age now, you are establishing your place on that declining curve. And the earlier you start keeping that curve as high as possible, the longer it will take you to decline. So if you wait until middle age to start getting healthier, you're not going to be able to go up as high as you could if you started high and stayed there. So what's happening, and let me see if I can draw that. What's happening is if you start at 20, you have, in one case, a person who's staying healthy and fit and not doing any of the bad things is still declining, but you're not going to notice it a lot. And another person who spends college and the time from 20 to 30 living a wastrel life and carousing and smoking and stress and all of that sort of stuff is going down much more quickly. Then if you start getting healthy, you'll be going down more slowly. You'll still be going down, but you're going down from a lower point. You may be able to bring it up toward the other curve, but you're starting behind. You're starting the game behind. So the people who are healthiest in old age and who live the longest are the ones who started out healthy and stayed healthy. And they've never allowed their bodies to go any lower than absolutely necessary. So, no, the fitness... and the recovery, the ability to recover from something and to deal with stresses, that from 20 on, actually probably if you look at it from childhood on, the earlier you work on that, the better. It's not just for old age. If you look at people who die in their 50s, they've been deteriorating often for a long time. And I can use my own high school class is an interesting example. The variability biologically across us, we're the cohort born in 42, and we graduated from high school in 60. And there are people in my high school graduating class who have died of old age. We're 64. And they have died of old age. There are also some that are great-grandparents. Blow me away, I just... But they started early, they had kids early, and their kids had kids early. So socially they're far advanced. And we have others who had their first kids. So one guy had his first child at 50. So he's, you know, the parent of a teenager now. Better him than me. But biologically, some of us have chronic diseases. One of my best friends in high school died about 6 months ago, spent the last year and a half in a nursing home. And I think about some of the things we did in high school, and I'm glad I stopped doing them. He didn't. And so he's was dead at 63. And spent that time in a nursing home. I don't intend to. So it's a wide variation. And when we get together, it's fascinating. We don't get together very often, and only a couple of us. But I don't know whether I mentioned it. When I was in England, I ran into, literally on a bus, one of my high school buddies that I hadn't seen in 45 years. It was quite an event. He also is extremely healthy. I say also because I consider myself very healthy. I don't have any chronic problems yet. Knock on wood. He also is in very good health and has been physically active all his life, has never smoked, loves beer, but is smart about it. And it was fascinating to see him because he's lived an orderly life and he's very, very healthy. Okay, enough about that. Question? Yep. Yep. And that does imply that people can go up way higher. I'm not sure how likely you are to cross that curve of somebody who's never had a problem. So these are hypothetical curves. So it's a conceptual rather than specific. You don't have to have an incredibly high fitness level to run a marathon. It's kind of a myth. But you need to have the aerobic capacity, and even the text points out that one of the things that's going to decline less is endurance. That people are made to walk and lope, if not run. And the guys who are running marathons in their 70s are not winning the Boston Marathon. They may be winning in their age class, but instead of 2 hours and whatever it is for the 20-year-olds or the 30-year-olds, they're in the four-hour group, but they're finishing it and they're able to recover. One of the differences is that their recovery is slower. The older you get, the longer it takes you to recover from a marathon. So it's, instead of being able to go back to running 3 or 4 days later, and I know one young marathon runner who starts running the next day. I don't know how he does it, but he finishes a marathon, sleeps 10 hours, gets up the next morning and continues his training. I keep waiting for his knees to quit, but he's fine. But when you're 70, you don't start running again for several days. You walk, and you go back into training slowly. So you run fewer in a year when you get older. So the performance changes, and you can see that in the times or the strength if you're looking at other sports, the difference between the 30-year-olds and the 70-year-olds, because the body is still declining, even though you're getting the best you can out of it. And that's the point, to get the best you can out of the body that you have. Yes? Yeah, the text suggests there are theories of aging, and it breaks them into two categories, the names of which I can't recall. No, I'm not going to recall them. Okay. But they will make a fine question on the exam. So make sure we ask one about that, since I said it in class. There are several, basically the two kinds. I'm not sure how the text, I'm on the 10th edition of this text, and they keep changing. This is a new thing in the text. But essentially, there are a group of hypotheses that suggest that aging and death are built into the body genetically. Genetic programming, and the other is variable rates. Okay. The genetic programming one essentially says that all organisms have a relatively fixed potential lifespan. And that's based on the, one person named Hayflick studied various organisms and discovered that their cells divide a particular number of times, and that the number of divisions appears to be built into the genetic code, and that some divide more slowly than others, some divide more more times than others, and for those organisms that are short-lived, they're either dividing quickly or they have few divisions built in genetically. And other organisms that live a long time are either or both, and dividing, their cells are dividing more slowly or they have more divisions built in. That it's a relatively controversial notion. Others suggest that in the process of division, it's not so much built into the genetic code that you can only divide a certain number of times, but each time you divide, the telomeres, and the text describes these, the ends of the chromosomes have a segment of the DNA called telomeres, which are essential for division. And one of the lines of research genetically is that there's a, I'm not sure whether that's an O or an E, telomerase, which is an enzyme produced by the genes, by the cells, in response to the genes, that the amount of telomerase declines as you age, and the length of the telomeres decreases until it reaches a point where your cells can't divide properly, and that's called the telomere theory of aging, and it's one of the genetically programmed ones. So one of the issues in aging research now is figuring out if you can somehow increase the length of the telomeres or the amount of telomerase available to the body so that the cells will continue to divide. And that's all very hypothetical. The variable rate group of theories mostly suggest that the body wears out and that you can speed that up or slow that down, and that's sort of the thing that we've been talking about before with the reserve capacity notion. And there are reasons, some of the arguments are that the cells begin to bond with each other, and that changes their functioning with age, that the space between cells becomes limited. There are others that argue that you have what are called free radicals. As a result of metabolism and cell division, the cells accumulate bits and pieces of genetic and cellular material that interfere with its functioning. That's kind of the trash on the streets theory. And there's another one that suggests that it's the toxins that we accumulate that interfere with cell functioning and eventually cause organs to fail. So that's the basis for some of the attempts to live longer by trying to live in a toxin-free environment, eat organically, clean out the toxins. There are some wonderful spas that you can pay lots and lots of money to, and they will detoxify your body. I love it. And what they do is basically they starve you to death for a week and feed you all kinds of interesting stuff that's supposed to rid your body of the toxins. And after they separate you from your money and a few pounds, they send you home to live longer. I don't want to belittle them. Actually, I did quite deliberately. The anti-aging enterprise is where I would invest my money if I had extra money, and I give you this advice. As we get older and older, and the baby boomers who have the money get older, there's going to be a huge increasing market for investors who want to invest in anything that promises to increase lifespan and help you overcome all the sins you've engaged in by the time you retire. So if you want good investments, invest in hearing aids for all of those of you who are going to rock concerts, or invest in heart valves, artificial hearts, artificial limbs, and schemes that will separate the rich from their money as they're trying to live forever. Yeah. I went over several of the theories in there. There are a couple more in the text. I just don't remember what they are. Those are the ones that I have at the top of my head. Okay, transactional perspective and constructivist perspective, and specifically in biological development, physical development. I use physical and biological interchangeably because I don't know the difference. There probably is a difference. I just don't know it. So I will use the, if I say physical, think biological. If I say biological, think physical. They're all one big mess to me. The transactional view is the one that, in general, transactional views say there are two sides to the development, and one way of thinking about it is that there's a body and it's in an environment, and the body is acting, exercising, doing things, and the environment is influencing the action. But just simply saying that whatever we're doing is in part determined by the environment that we're in, and as we do it, we're changing the environment that we're in. So you've got a look at both. And it's particularly important in thinking about brain development and motor development that you're not just, your body's not developing independent of the environment that you're in. And the environment includes the nutrition, the viruses, the healthcare, the amount of money you have that gives you access to medical care, all of those sorts of things are impacting your physical development. And at the same time, what is going on in your body is impacting the way you interact with the environment. So you're changing your environment, you're taking advantage of the opportunities or not, and you're adapting to that environment. How would you illustrate it? The processes of differentiation and integration.
Crawling.
Okay, what do you have to differentiate? Okay. Arms from legs, left from right. You have to do both of those. And then you have to put them together. In any illustration, it's important to go before the differentiation and describe what the original point was, the undifferentiated state. So in crawling, as an example, the infant moves arms and legs together, and the infant uses both arms and both legs in the same way before it crawls. Before it can crawl, it has to separate the arms from the legs so it can move one independent of the other. So it has to go from the undifferentiated, I move everything at once state, to now I can move my arms separately from my legs and vice versa, and I can move my two arms in different directions at the same time. Now I can put those differentiations together, I can integrate them into being able to move my arms and legs in a coordinated fashion that lets me not fall over on my face. But in order to crawl, you have to be able to lift a hand, you have to be able to lift a leg. And think about it. Think about crawling, right? Think about crawling. You have to lift one at a time, and you have to lift the leg and move it forward, and you have to lift an arm and move it forward, but you can't do those at the same time or you fall over. So you have to do the upper part and the bottom part separately, and you have to do the left and right alternatingly, or if you don't, and I actually watched a kid who was learning to crawl but couldn't figure out how to lift up his left arm. So there he was, and for some reason he was not lifting his left arm, but he could do the leg. So he was rotating around his left hand. He was never picking up his left hand. And he was moving forward, but he was moving forward around his left hand. It was like a four-wheel drive vehicle with one wheel stuck. He was going around in circles. He couldn't figure out. And I don't know what was wrong with the connection to his left hand. But in order to crawl successfully, you have to integrate and make it a very sophisticated system. But the first step is the undifferentiated state, then the differentiations that you have to make, and then how you put them together for the more sophisticated motion. Another illustration would come from the embryonic development of the arm. You start off an undifferentiated state, you've got an arm bud. It's just there. But as it grows, it's going to become an upper arm and a lower arm. That's a differentiation. If it didn't, you would just simply have a peninsula. It would be the same kind of structure. You just have, I don't know, a protrusion out there. But if it didn't differentiate, you wouldn't have an elbow or wrist, thumbs, fingers, any of those. So it goes from the undifferentiated bud, which actually gets fairly long, but then it differentiates so that it creates a difference between the upper arm and the lower arm. Then it differentiates again to create a wrist, hand ray, and then the hand ray differentiates to create finger rays and thumb. And then eventually all of that has to be integrated back together so that you have all the parts separately innervated. You've got nerves that go to the whole thing, which are going to make it possible for you eventually to move it, move each part of it independently and do that incredibly sophisticated integrated movement of the arm and fingers and thumbs and let you twirl your baton and your pencil and play the flute and all those other things. So in looking at differentiation and integration, there are many ways you could illustrate it. Part of the challenge is to find a new one. But always in illustrating it, start with the undifferentiated state, then talk about how the parts get differentiated, and then how those get integrated. So you're talking about the same example, from undifferentiated to integrated. It was a longer answer than you wanted, but you needed it. The second part of the earlier question was a constructivist view. And a constructivist view, you go back on the website and in your lecture notes, constructivist view takes the assumption that you start off with little pieces and you add them to each other. In many ways, it's related to the differentiation and integration. A constructivist view says, for example, in motor development, I'm going to differentiate each of these pieces and learn to control them, and then I'm going to put them together, and I'm going to put them together in increasingly large structures so that I'm going to learn to control my arm, and I'm going to learn to control my leg, and then I'm going to construct a larger motion out of that by putting my arm and my leg together so that I can crawl, for example. And then I'm going to add to that another movement and learn to, I don't know, where do I go from crawling? To crawling and carrying something. Yeah, that's a more sophisticated piece. How do you crawl and carry something? Think about that. Think about holding something in your hand that you want to transport across the room. Okay, you've already got holding something in your hand. You can do that. If I carry you, you can hold it and you can get it to the other side. But now that you can crawl, you want to carry it yourself. So now, how am I going to put those things together? And I will construct a more sophisticated way of crawling that allows me to hang on to something and transport it. It's one of the most fascinating things in the world to watch kids who are learning to be mobile learn to carry things. And so you drag them along. That's one way to do it. So you put it in your hand and then you crawl with it in your hand and you drag it. You can put it in your mouth and crawl if it's small enough and carry it. But then you can actually put something. And here's your challenge. Get a cup of tea, put it in your hand, hold it in your hand, and see if you can crawl. With it, without spilling the tea. And we don't expect a 10-month-old to do that, but you can figure out how to crawl and carry something. And what you're doing is constructing a more flexible, more varied way of moving and carrying something. And probably if you get really good, you can figure out how to crawl, except it's not going to be a crawl. You're going to have to modify it, and carry a cup of tea in each hand. You can probably figure out how to do that. Right? You've probably never done it. You can construct a scheme for doing that. And the constructivist approach says that you take the pieces as you develop them and construct larger and larger repertoires of motion with them. Do you need to know the different parts of the brain? No. I mean, it's nice to know them, but I won't ask a question that requires you to differentiate the parts of the brain. It might be useful just to hang on to the notion that the lower parts of the brain, which control breathing and being conscious, those sorts of things, that those evolved earlier and they develop early, and then the cortex develops later. The higher, more sophisticated cognitive functions are located in the cortex. But you don't need to know that. Yes?
One of the questions here is, can biological does development decrease after slow down?
Can you speed up or slow down biological development? How might you do that? Okay, would hormones do it? Maybe. Okay. I suggested testosterone will kick off pubertal changes. So the administration of hormones could do that. I talked a bit about having puberty happen earlier if you're female, if there are non-biologically related males past puberty in your household. And I must report, I didn't bring it with me, but this is new information, but it's connected. There was an article in the Free Press yesterday reporting on a study that suggested that it may not actually be quite as I was assuming that it is. It may be not that the biologically unrelated males are speeding up puberty. It may be, or it may also be, that fathers, biological fathers, slow down puberty. They delay it. So having your father living with you, your biological father, may slow down growth into puberty. So it may be one or the other, maybe both, leading to the results in the literature. Their speculation was pheromones. Pheromones do everything. All those interesting chemicals that your endocrine system creates that we are unaware of, but that you can actually measure if you can concentrate them. The pheromones are what let the butterflies find each other to mate. Yeah. Scent signals. And we have receptors for lots of chemicals that we haven't mapped and we don't know what they respond to, but there are probably all kinds of interesting things. Chemistry is really fun. Organic chemistry.
When you mentioned that, like, the only thing I could think of is that, like, you know how they say, like, when girls spend a lot of time together, they will have the same cycle at the same time? Mm-hmm. Living in a household with women affects a girl who is about to go through puberty in that sort of the same way or not?
Interesting question. The question is, it starts with the observation that women who live together, college dorms, housemates, sisters, who live together tend to synchronize their menstrual cycles. And that's been established for a long time. The question is, would a prepubescent girl be responding to that synchronization? And how might that show up either in the process of puberty or in other changes in her body? And I don't have a clue, but it's a really interesting question.
Being
in the home is slowing down the growing puberty. Wouldn't that be another way to
see that? Because there's no biological problem. I'm sorry, I'm not tracking the question. Well, we were just talking about how a young girl would
be slower to go hit puberty
right.
if she was living with her biological father.
Right.
And you're saying the last time you said that it was living with another biological
father. Right, non-biological. Right.
Male. But then if the one that you just introduced today was correct, then when a young girl is living with only women, wouldn't it be this, it should also be about them, right?
No, that complicates the question more, and I'm not going to repeat the question for those of you who are listening on the web. I'm going to try to integrate the questions. You have potentially several different effects going on, and one is the presence of the biologically related male father slowing down puberty, delaying puberty. You have another potential effect of a non-biologically related male stepfather speeding up puberty. And the difficulty of sorting those out is that when you're doing the research, you're looking at the comparison of biologically related fathers and non-biologically related stepfathers or males. So you're looking at those two groups separately. The third group that you could look at is women with no males in the household at all, and I'm not aware that any of the research has done that. They may have, I just don't have it. So maybe that's the baseline. Maybe they're in the middle someplace. I don't know. Talia, remind me to try to tease that out from some of that literature. That's the speed or the rate of development. The synchronization is a different issue, and that happens, that's based on the pheromones among the women and is independent of the presence of males. So I used to be close to a family where there were four daughters and a mother and a father, great family, four daughters. After the second daughter became pubescent and started, or became mature and started to menstruate, that meant there were three menstruating women in the household and two more coming up. The father figured out in his job that he needed to coordinate his travel so that he was away. Because he had to be away about 1 week a month. And he figured out that life was a lot easier if he skipped the premenstrual week as he experienced the fact that all three of the women who were menstruating in the same week. And the premenstrual period was not a happy time. And he did that until there were only two women left. He changed jobs along the way, but he sent three of them off to college. So for about 6 years he traveled, and he did it deliberately. He checked his schedule and he planned his travel for those weeks when he could predict it, and they were very regular. But all five of the women would menstruate in the same week, and he said the few days running up to that were just hell. You didn't want to be around because they were all moody and sensitive, and he had to watch what he said, and he was basically a nice guy, but it was really easy to annoy them. And when you get five women annoyed at you at the same time, you might as well travel. No point being home. But I've seen the research on roommates, suite mates in college, boarding school, private schools, girls who live together. And I asked the question once. I had a group of nuns in a class, and they report the same thing. Yeah. They were kind of giggly about it. Interesting group of people to ask about menstruation. But they reported that in the convent, they had seen the same thing. They all tended to menstruate at the same time. But that's independent of the presence of men, as far as I know. Showstopper, huh? In my family, we call that a verbal lampshade. You know what happens at a party when somebody gets too drunk, puts a lampshade on their head, and you just everybody just goes, "Yeah, that's a verbal lampshade." Yeah. I suggested that you try drawing the placenta, the uterus, the umbilical cord, the fetus, put all of that in its appropriate context. I won't ask you to do it on the exam, but I do ask you to make sure that you have a pretty clear picture of, for example, where is the placenta attached to the uterus? I've had, it's one of the fun things, that's why I encourage you to do it, because I've asked first year students to just go to the board and do it in smaller classes, and discovered that, you know, they got the placenta on the outside of the uterus. And it's not where it is. And with it, but in the process of trying to draw it, they realized they don't know. The placenta is on the inside wall of the uterus, which is where the embryo is and the fetus. It's all inside the uterus, not attached to the outside. So it surfaces some interesting misconceptions sometimes. So just try it, just to make sure you're clear about how it all fits together, how it's all integrated. But I won't ask you to do it on the exam. We can't grade drawings.
So we need to know, where stuff is.
Where stuff is. The car keys and yeah, you should be able to think about where the cervix is and where the uterus is, where where implantation happens, where the ovaries are. The ovaries are not in your uterus. And just be clear when you're describing something about prenatal development or birth that you've got those things clear, because I collect the statements that people write that are just sometimes mind-boggling. For example, it happens in genetics is where I collect them too. People write things like the cells in your DNA or the cells in your genes. Excuse me, the DNA is in the cells, not vice versa. It's just a matter of getting the grammar straight and figuring out how these things are connected to each other.
Just kind of new to the topic, some of them are kind of trick questions, aren't they? Like, when does that stop benefiting you? Well, it doesn't.
Right. Yeah, well, they're trick or sneaky. In the study questions, no holds barred. I'll ask any kind of silly question in there, trick question. I will not on the exam. I will not ask sneaky questions or trick questions on the exam. Everything is straightforward. If we goof, and I occasionally goof, it's Talia's fault. Because she's supposed to catch those. She's supposed to say, "Larry, that is a nasty, sneaky question." And I'll say, let's change it so it's straightforward. All the questions do have right answers. And they are all covered in lecture or the text or both. The question is, do you need to know specific definitions? Are there definition questions? I try not to ask simple definitional questions, like what is the definition of placenta? I try not to ask those because I assume that you do know the definitions, and I'd rather get to the more complex question that assumes that you know the definition. So yes, you should know the definitions in the sense of knowing what differentiation is or knowing what an embryo is. But I won't ask you a question that requires you to specifically define it. But you should know the concepts. And the text is really good about providing definitions and pretty good with examples of things. That's why I use it, because I think it does a fair job of that.
make a person more sociable than her genetic potential.
Yeah, that's in the third unit, right? The question was, study question, can you make a person more sociable than her genetic potential would allow? In the second unit, the question is, can you make a person more intelligent than his or her genetic potential would allow? In the first unit, this one is, can you make a person taller than his or her genetic potential would allow? And that's the trick question that's consistent. No, you can't. If you can do it, it's within your genetic potential. You're playing around within the range of potentials. And the only way you could do it would be, well, in the second and third units, you can't. In the first unit, the only way you could make a person taller than his or her potential would be to do something bionic. Right. And the example is giving growth hormone to somebody to increase their height. The genetic potential of the body is to respond to growth hormone when it's administered. And you're creating an unusual circumstance for that body, but if it's going to respond, that's within its genetic potential. And you wouldn't do something like give it marshmallows to increase its height, because the body doesn't have the genetic potential to respond to marshmallow, especially injected into your veins by increasing absurd example, but we use medications or treatments because the body has the genetic potential to respond to them. But whatever happens is within that range of potential. And you brought up, I will throw in a piece, there's a little soapbox about 1 minute that I didn't say in class, which is that pediatricians who still use the prediction of height from how tall you are when you're two should probably have to go back to medical school, because they don't work. There is no predictability from your age to height to your ultimate height. What there is a predictability from where you are, your percentile when you're two in weight, to when you are likely to enter puberty. But that's a completely different issue. Parents really aren't particularly interested in that issue. But the correlation between your height at age two and your height as an adult is just about zero. We were very clearly told by a very good pediatrician that our son would be about 5'6". He's 5'9 and a half. And it's bogus. What it is based on is, or the reason people do it, is that they don't understand that there are several sources of variability in growth rate and progress. And where you are at two is just not a good predictor, because it's not going to tell you anything about how you're going to go through puberty. It's not going to tell you anything about the length or the height of the growth spurt. And that's what's going to determine your final height. So it's just, I don't know why people do it. And I keep reading things that say, it's bogus, it doesn't work, don't do it. Why upset parents? Why give them hope that their daughter will be 6'3 when she may not be 6'3? My daughter wanted to be 6 feet. And she's one of her great disappointments in life is that she didn't get there. Not No. The question is whether stress at puberty is likely to cause major changes in your growth. And it's not, because most of your organs are already formed, except for the ovaries or the testicles. They're fairly mature. And you're not going to do much more than delay. Stress is not going to do much more than delay, except there may be some brain changes that we just don't know about. The effects of stress on the brain at puberty is essentially an unstudied area. We simply don't know. We do know what traumatization or abuse in childhood does to the brain, but we don't know much about later trauma and about how it affects brain development, and we also don't know much about recovery from stress-induced biological difference later in childhood or adolescence. One of those things that if you want a great career and you're interested in physiology and the brain, you know, lots of room there for a Nobel Prize. Hungry? Full? Brain full, tummy empty? It's probably a good time to stop. Thank you. Good questions. I like those.